September 7th, the Queens Gaels will host the York Lions at Richardson Memorial Stadium. Last year, Queens walked into York Stadium and left with a resounding, historic victory. But this is not the same program we saw 1 year ago. A new era is dawning at York University. A new coach, new players, and new culture has restored the roar. A team that once fought just to survive is once again playing with pride. Now the Lions will look to even the score. Can York record their first ever victory against the Gaels? Or will Queens continue their royal rule over the Lions? Tune in to CFRC 101.9 FM or CFRC.ca to catch all the bone-crunching action. 2:45 pregame show, 3 p.m. kickoff. We hope to see you there. No static. Every Monday from 6 to 8 on CFRC. Every Monday from 6 to 8 on CFRC 101.9 FM and CFRC.ca. You never know what you're gonna get. CFRC's most varied variety show. You never know what you're gonna get. You never know what you're gonna get. CFRC's most varied variety show. Hosted by your friends, Mike and Chance. No static. No static. CFRC 101.9 FM. CFRC.ca. CFRC.ca/no_static.
Is Democracy Now.
I still don't believe this is real. Like, I knew a girl that got shot in her leg, and it really broke me because she was like a sister to me, and I don't know how to react to it.
A 14-year-old student opens fire at his Georgia high school, killing two other 14-year-olds and two teachers in the deadliest U.S. school shooting this year. We'll speak with a Georgia state representative who introduced a bill calling for stricter rules for firearm storage, and with the president of Brady, one of the oldest gun violence prevention organizations in the United States. Then, as university students return to campus for the fall, we look at the crackdown on pro-Palestine students and professors.
After the state of Illinois dropped all charges against us, I found out the same day that my fall classes had been suspended and I was not going to be allowed to teach until I went through an investigation that is going to investigate, among other things, my commitment to objectivity in journalism.
Northwestern University professor Stephen Thrasher will join us to talk about his suspension for the first time publicly. We'll also be joined by Columbia University professor Catherine Frankie, who's being investigated after an interview on Democracy Now! About a chemical attack on pro-Palestinian student activists on the Columbia campus. We'll also speak with Frankie's attorney, who is a senior partner at her law firm for years, but resigned after the firm dropped Professor Frankie as a client, saying she was too controversial. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In the occupied West Bank, at least five Palestinians were killed today in an Israeli airstrike on a car in the city of Tubas. A sixth Palestinian, 16-year-old Majed Fida Abu Zaina, was shot dead by Israeli forces in the Fatah refugee camp near Tubas. The Wafa news agency reports Israeli forces barred ambulances from reaching the boy and dragged his body out of the camp using a military bulldozer. On Wednesday, mourners held a funeral procession near Jenin for a Palestinian girl killed by an Israeli sniper. This is the girl Lujain's father, Osama Musleh.
طبعا الجيش محاصر البلد.
The soldiers are surrounding the town. I tried to save her. I tried to do something, but I couldn't. The army is surrounding our area. I called for an ambulance. They arrived late because a sniper shot towards them. She was 16 years old. The only thing she did is she looked from the window and the soldiers saw her and shot her. One bullet that targeted her forehead.
At least 19 people have been killed in Jenin since last week when Israel launched its largest West Bank offensive in two decades. Jenin's governor, Kamal Abu al-Rub, said Israeli armored bulldozers have razed 70% of Jenin's streets, destroying more than a dozen miles of water and sewage pipes, along with electrical and communication cables. Jenin's main public hospital has been locked down, and 4,000 Jenin residents have been forced from their homes at gunpoint.
The situation in the areas which are under siege is bad. The Israeli army is preventing food, water, ambulances, and journalists from reaching these besieged areas, so we don't know what is happening in the areas which they consider to be military closed areas. We are getting lots of calls for help. This invasion is the worst, largest, and most painful to Palestinian people because the Israeli army is destroying the infrastructure, which means a blow to the local economy in Jenin.
In the Gaza Strip, Israeli attacks have killed at least 18 Palestinians since Wednesday. One assault on a tent encampment for displaced Palestinians killed four people near Al-Aqsa Martyrs Hospital in central Gaza. The strike destroyed dozens of tents, wounded many others, including children. In southern Gaza, medical workers have begun vaccinating tens of thousands of Palestinian children in the city of Khan Yunis against polio, the second stage of a UN-led polio eradication effort. Meanwhile, Hamas has accused Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu of deliberately undermining efforts to forge a ceasefire and hostage release deal by refusing to withdraw Israeli troops from the Philadelphia corridor along Gaza's border with Egypt. This comes as newly published documents show how Netanyahu and Israeli negotiators purposefully prolonged Israel's assault on Gaza by making new demands during ceasefire talks. The documents, published by the Israeli newspaper Yedioth Ahronot, also reveal three of the six hostages found dead in Gaza last weekend were due for release under a ceasefire agreement drafted in May. President Biden said Monday Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is not doing enough to reach a ceasefire and hostage release deal. On Tuesday, a group of more than two dozen rights organizations, including Amnesty International and Refugees International, sent the Biden-Harris administration a letter highlighting, quote, international and U.S. law, as well as your administration's policies require suspending weapons transfers to the Israeli government, unquote. The Portland City Council in Maine unanimously voted to divest all funds from companies complicit in Israeli human rights violations and war crimes against Palestinians. Organizers say Portland is the fourth U.S. city and the first on the East Coast to adopt such a divestment resolution, which comes after intense campaigning from rights groups, including Maine Coalition for Palestine and Jewish Voice for Peace Maine. Meta has ruled the phrase "from the river to the sea" is not hate speech. Pro-Israel groups have accused people who use the longstanding rallying cry for Palestinian liberation of being anti-Semitic and attempted to shut down speech promoting Palestinian rights on social media. But Meta's oversight board ruled "from the river to the sea" is, quote, often used as a political call for solidarity, equal rights, and self-determination of the Palestinian people and to end the war in Gaza, unquote. In Georgia, a 14-year-old boy shot and killed two other 14-year-olds and two students at Appalachie High School in the city of Winder on Wednesday morning in the deadliest school shooting this year. At least nine others were injured. Authorities said Colt Gray, who used an AR platform-style weapon in Wednesday's rampage, will stand murder charges as an adult. This is 15-year-old student Itzel Navarrete, who survived the shooting.
All of us, including me, I was crying. I was shaking, and I just didn't know where my mind was. I was just so scared. But yeah, a lot of us were just crying. All you hear is crying. All you hear is like the sirens from outside. So it made us even more scared because we were like, "Oh, it's real! It's real!" We didn't know how to react.
The shooter killed two students and two teachers. The teenage suspect was on the FBI's radar as far back as May of 2023, was interviewed when he was 13 years old, along with his father, about anonymous online threats. His father said he kept hunting guns in the family home. Appalachia High School reportedly received a threat by phone ahead of the shooting, with the caller warning five schools would be targeted, starting with Appalachia. After headlines, we'll go to Georgia for the latest. In Britain, Prime Minister Keir Starmer issued an apology Wednesday as the results of a seven-year-long investigation into the Grenfell Tower fire concluded the disaster was avoidable and was caused by decades of failure by the UK government and systematic dishonesty of the companies that provided insulation and other construction materials in the London Tower block. The fire killed 72 people, many of them children, most of them from low-income and immigrant families. This is Natasha Elcock, a survivor and spokesperson for the group Grenfell United.
We paid the price of systematic dishonesty, institutional indifference and neglect. Today, we send a message to Keir Starmer and his government. This country has been failed by governments of all political persuasions. Our expectation is your government will break old habits and implement all the recommendations made by Sir Martin Morbick's report without further delay. Because the time to address this is already three decades too late.
Go to democracynow.org to see our interview with a Grenfell survivor. In Germany, the far-right Alternative for Germany, or AfD party, won an election in the eastern state of Thuringia and came in second in neighboring Saxony, sending shockwaves throughout Germany and Europe. It's unlikely the AfD will be able to form a ruling coalition as other parties refuse to work with them, and Chancellor Olaf Scholz has called on German lawmakers to lock the Nationalist Party out of any talks. Alice Weidel is co-leader of Alternative for Germany.
Our school classes are being flooded with children and young people from foreign cultures who come from archaic backgrounds, marked by Muslim beliefs. They are uneducated and all they speak is gibberish. Children no longer learn anything, and this is the result as to why those young people who still want to have a perspective in our country have supported the AfD as much as they have.
This is the first time a far-right party has won a German election since the 1930s. In 1930, the Nazi party won Thuringia state. 3 years later, Adolf Hitler became Germany's chancellor. In other news from Germany, Munich police officers shot and killed a man near the Israeli consulate and Nazi documentation center earlier today after he opened fire on police officers. Meanwhile, in news from France, President Emmanuel Macron has named former EU Brexit negotiator Michel Barnier as France's new prime minister after rejecting calls to appoint a progressive leader following a victory by a leftist coalition in July's snap elections. Barnier is a longtime conservative from the Les Républicains party. Back in the United States, President Biden could make his current hardline border restrictions permanent, according to administration officials. In June, Biden issued a temporary executive order sealing off the border when the number of asylum seekers exceeds a daily average of 2,500 for 1 week, and allowing border agents to quickly turn away migrants. The asylum ban being considered would make the executive order a permanent feature of U.S. immigration policy and further lower the threshold at which migrants are rejected. The ACLU and others have sued Biden over the policy. In campaign news, Kamala Harris has agreed to propose rules for her ABC News debate with Donald Trump September 10th, including having mics muted when a candidate has not been given the floor, although Harris's team said it would disadvantage her. And in other campaign news, Liz Cheney, the former Wyoming congressmember who served in the House Republican leadership and voted to impeach Trump, has endorsed Kamala Harris for president. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman in New York, joined by Juan Gonzalez in Chicago. Hi, Juan.
Hi, Amy, and welcome to all of our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world.
In Georgia, a 14-year-old student opened fire at the Appalachia High School in the city of Winder Wednesday, killing two students, both also age 14. Mason Schermerhorn and Christian Angulo, and two teachers, Richard Aspinwall and Christina Irimi. At least 9 other people were wounded and taken to the hospital with injuries. The shooter surrendered to school resource officers immediately when confronted and was taken into custody. He's facing murder charges as an adult. It marked the deadliest school shooting in the United States this year. Authorities are still looking into how the 14-year-old Colt Gray obtained the AR platform-style weapon used in the shooting. The teen shooter was on the FBI's radar as far back as May of last year, after the agency received anonymous tips about online threats to commit an unspecified school shooting. The FBI referred the case to the sheriff's department in Jackson County. The sheriff's office interviewed the then 13-year-old boy and his father, who said there were hunting guns in the house, but the teen didn't have unsupervised access to them. The teen also denied making any online threats. The sheriff's office alerted local schools for continued monitoring of the teen, but said there was no probable cause for arrest. Appalachie High School also reportedly received a phone threat ahead of Wednesday's shooting, with the caller warning 5 schools would be targeted, starting with Appalachie. We go now to Johns Creek, Georgia, where we're joined by Georgia State Representative Michelle Au. She introduced a bill in the Georgia House of Representatives last year calling for stricter rules for firearm storage. She's also a practicing physician in Metro Atlanta. We welcome you to Democracy Now! Can you start off, Michelle Au, by talking about your response to this horrific event, this attack on the high school, and what you are demanding?
Thank you so much, Amy. And this is a very sad day for all of us here in Georgia and around the country. I think that a lot of us, when we saw the news breaking about the shooting at Appalachie High School, we were shocked, of course, but we were not surprised, because I think that in the United States of America, this type of incident has become really quite routine, right? And the most tragic thing about seeing these types of events happen and hearing that 4 people were killed and 9 people injured is that all these types of events are preventable. In fact, I think we heard when you were teeing up the story that there were several points at which we could have intervened or prevented this type of thing from happening. But nonetheless, we saw what happened yesterday, and it's an unspeakable tragedy for the community.
And Representative Au, could you talk about the legislation that you've introduced and your hopes of possibly getting a passage of that legislation?
Yes. So last session, I introduced a bill called HB 161, which is entitled the Pediatric Health Safe Storage Act. Now, the reason we called it the Pediatric Health Safe Storage Act is that in the United States of America, gun violence is the number one cause of death in children and teenagers in this country, right? So that is a statistic that requires not just attention, but action, right? So this bill that I introduced is it's quite simple. People can look it up. It's only 3 pages long. And all it does is it requires that any firearm that can be accessed by a minor, someone 18 or younger, be locked up securely, period. That's it, right? So this is the type of legislation that is very straightforward. It's very logical. And it should have been easy to pass, right? Because I think that we can agree as a society that children and teenagers should not have such easy, unsupervised access to weapons, right? But there is something about guns in this country that make it very difficult to behave and act on what is essentially a public health issue, a public health crisis. And the fact that this bill got a hearing in the state of Georgia was incredible progress. I think people realize that we do have to start moving on these types of issues. But I was disheartened to see that they would refuse still to bring such a straightforward bill to vote. Of course, now in the aftermath of the shooting, we do wish that this bill had been voted through, because it could have prevented this tragedy.
And meanwhile, your governor seems to be going in the opposite direction. Governor Kemp, in 2022, he signed a permitless carry law in Georgia. Can you talk about that?
That's correct. In the state of Georgia, it is a state with the Republican trifecta, And what that means is that Republicans hold the majority in the House and the Senate, and we have a Republican governor. So what this has translated to is it's been quite difficult to move even the most basic type of gun safety legislation. In fact, what we've seen is that Georgia actually has some of the most lax gun laws in the country, which is, of course, correlated with having a very high incident of preventable gun violence. Instead of passing the types of common sense gun safety legislation that I talked about, instead, our Republican governor has championed loosening gun laws. And in 2022, as you noted, he passed SB 319, which is a permitless carry law, which enables people to carry loaded weapons in public without any sort of permit. Inherent in the permit is also included a background check. So what we are allowing is taking away a safety net for people to be able to buy guns without a background check, because we know that in America, if you buy guns through private gun sales or transfers, you are not required to go through a federal background check, right? And also then being able to carry loaded guns in public, again, without a background check. So we're really taking away a lot of the safety measures that we can recognize are important when we're talking about loaded guns in public.
Michelle Au, we want to thank you so much for being with us. Practicing physician in Atlanta and a member of the Georgia House of Representatives, she introduced a House bill last year for stricter rules for firearm storage. I want to bring in Chris Brown, president of Brady, one of the oldest gun violence prevention organizations in the United States, named after Jim Brady, who was the press spokesperson for President Ronald Reagan. When there was an attempted assassination of President Reagan, Brady was shot in the head. Chris Brown, if you can take this story national. Yesterday, when Kamala Harris, running for president, was getting ready to give her economy address in New Hampshire, she had to address this issue because the shooting had taken place. But I didn't hear her calling for an assault weapons ban. Can you talk about what Brady is calling for?
Brady has long called for an assault weapons ban. Jim and Sarah Brady are responsible for the federal assault weapons ban that was put into effect the year after the Brady Law passed in 1993. During the 10-year time period that that assault weapons ban was in effect, you saw a marked decrease in the kinds of mass shootings involving those firearms than in the previous period. And certainly in the subsequent period, what you're seeing is a stark increase of the use of those kinds of firearms, including reports show in this particular shooting. So we'll continue to push at the House and Senate in the next session of Congress to pass an assault weapons ban. And I will tell you, across the country, we poll on this. We've looked at this over the past many, many years, from really 2018 forward. There is a growing, increasing desire for an assault weapons ban in this country, all across the country, including among Republicans and including among gun owners. So we will certainly push the Harris administration, if we have one, to make that a priority and to call for one, just as Joe Biden always did.
And Chris Brown, could you talk about why President Biden has emphasized the need for common sense gun safety legislation, and yet we continue to have, despite the decline in some influence of the National Rifle Association, we still have no real progress on nationwide legislation. What needs to be done to get Congress to act?
Well, let me push back a little bit. We have had marked progress thanks to President Joe Biden and his consistent leadership on this issue for broad and comprehensive gun violence prevention. And he achieved, frankly, the impossible. Even I did not think it could happen, which was the passage of the Bipartisan Safer Communities Act about 2.5 years ago. And just remember, we had 16 Republican members of the United States Senate supporting that law, because it was passed shortly after the horrific school shooting at Uvalde. So we have made progress at the federal level, very important progress, I might add. But what Joe Biden has had to do as president, because Congress hasn't acted on some other important things, is pass a number of requirements through executive action. And that's not the same thing as a congressional law. Those actions, which beef up the enforcement power of the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms, that's the agency that regulates the gun dealers all across this country, of which we have more than McDonald's and Starbucks combined, for example. He's beefed those up. He's regulated ghost guns. Congress should have done it, but he did it. He had ATF pass a rule that provides the most comprehensive expansion of the background check system ever, because Congress still hasn't expanded the Brady background check system after the loopholes that exist, because you can buy guns online and you can buy them from gun shows. So his leadership has been exceptional. I just hope that that leadership continues with the next president. And certainly if you look at what Kamala Harris typically talks about on the campaign trail, she usually does name gun violence as a top priority issue that she wants to tackle. And she is currently the leader of the Office of Gun Violence Prevention, an office that Joe Biden created that is doing incredible work for an all of government approach to tackle this epidemic.
Chris Brown, we only have a minute, but I wanted to go back to 2022. To Republican Congressman Mike Collins, who represents the Georgia district where Appalachia High School is, who posted this video on social media where he holds and shoots an assault weapon.
Well, Joe, I got some news for you. Let me tell you what Georgians really believe. First of all, you count the legal votes that were cast in the state of Georgia. Donald Trump won this state, period. You see, Georgians are sick and tired of weak-kneed, spineless politicians who won't fight for Trump, get to the bottom of 2020, and fix our elections. Well, if they won't do it, Mike Collins will.
So that's Republican Congressman Mike Collins, who represents the Georgia district where the massacre just took place yesterday. Your final response?
I, to some extent, I honestly have no words. What we see there, we see in far too many members of Congress still, people like Lauren Boebert and others who wear assault weapon pins on the floor of the House of Representatives. So I guess my final word is, look, we have children and educators dead today because we have people like Mike Collins in office whose view of the Second Amendment is so extreme that they're fine with it being a death sentence to their fellow Americans. So I encourage all of us, safely store your guns, please. If you have kids in the home, think about the risks that they pose or that the if they're going through things, and remove guns from the home and vote for gun sense candidates. They're running up and down the ballot, including probably in districts that look a lot like this. And that's the only way that we will tackle this issue. Better people in office, better enforcement of the laws, and changing the gun culture so anyone who has a gun in the home safely stores it. And then we can end this carnage.
Chris Brown, president of Brady, named for Jim Brady, the White House press spokesperson for President Ronald Reagan. Brady shot in the head during the attempted assassination of President Reagan. Next up, as university students and professors return to campus for the fall, we looked at the crackdown on pro-Palestine students and professors. Stay with us. Shoots by Godspeed, You Black Emperor. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman in New York, joined with Juan Gonzalez in Chicago. As students return to school for the fall, we spend the rest of the hour looking at how university administrators continue to crack down on Gaza Solidarity student protests and professors. An op-ed in the Chronicle of Higher Education called it a, quote, assault on the truth. We begin with a guest who last joined us in May, after he was attacked by name during a congressional hearing about pro-Palestine protests on college campuses. As Republican Congressmember Jim Banks grilled Northwestern University President Michael Schill, he singled out Northwestern University journalism professor Stephen Thrasher, who'd been to the Gaza Solidarity encampments at Northwestern in Chicago and other schools as a professor and as a journalist.
Stephen Thrasher, who's one of the goons in the photo behind me, he's a professor of journalism at Northwestern. He and several of your faculty members locked arms. They scuffled with police officers, blocked the police officers on your campus from doing their job. Do they continue to teach students at Northwestern University after this embarrassing incident?
So I will not comment on individual faculty members,
President,
nor on matters.
Is it your decision and your decision alone to allow those professors to continue to teach students on your campus?
We believe in due process at Northwestern University.
You believe in due process except for the decision that you made about Coach Fitzgerald.
We followed the contract.
Have
that
your
was
cake and eat
process.
It too.
We had an investigation, but I'm not going to go on and on about that.
After this congressional hearing, Northwestern filed charges against Professor Stephen Thrasher for allegedly obstructing police at the encampment, which Cook County prosecutors dropped. Since then, Professor Thrasher has continued to speak out, but students at Northwestern will not see him in their classrooms as they return to campus because he's been suspended with pay, as Northwestern says he's under investigation. He's joining us today in New York to publicly speak about this for the first time. Stephen Thrasher is an acclaimed journalist and author of The Viral Underclass, The Human Toll When Inequality and Disease Collide. His forthcoming book is called The Overseer Class, Representation as Repression. He is at the Medill School of Journalism at Northwestern University, Chair of Social Justice and Reporting. Professor Thrasher, welcome back to Democracy Now! Why don't you explain in your own words what has happened to you since the Gaza protests?
Thanks for having me, Amy. So at the Gaza encampment, as you saw in the video, I was one of a number of professors and graduate students who surrounded our students to try to make sure that nobody hurt them. The day before, there had been horrific violence at several other universities where we'd seen that students had been brutally hurt by university police. And I was on Democracy Now! And did some therapy and thought things were kind of going okay by the time that I finished the school year and planned to go offline for the summer to work on my next book. I was out of the country for the whole summer. And actually, the day that I had left the United States and landed in Europe, I found out that the Northwestern police wanted to talk to me and eventually found out that I was one of four people that they're pressing charges against. Now, it was really disturbing. This was many months after the fact. Like many other situations and other campuses, all four of us had been very outspoken who were being charged, and most of us were LGBTQ people. And we found out that they were pressing these charges. And the state of Illinois had thrown out all kinds of other cases. They threw out our case as well. But the day that I found out that the state of Illinois was throwing out the charges, I also found out that my fall classes had been canceled and that I was not going to be allowed to teach in the fall pending an investigation. So this was, of course, very upsetting, particularly, and this is something I'm hoping that Professor Franke might speak about as well, particularly because my classes were very very LGBTQ classes. I'm the Daniel Renberg Chair of Social Justice and Reporting with a focus on the LGBTQ community. And I also was teaching a class on LGBTQ recording methods and viruses and viral media. So my classes were canceled. I'm the only person who teaches LGBTQ classes. I had to let 8 different people know who I had contracted to be a grading assistant, to come in as guest speakers, to do tours, who were all LGBTQ journalists and alum. I had to let them know that they wouldn't be working as well. And of course, it was a huge disappointment to our LGBTQ students. It was really odd to hear President Schill talk about due process, because I've received no due process and being taken out of the classes. I'm still being paid, but I did not get the fair due process. I was told that I would not be allowed until investigations into complaints against me, to intemperate social media usage, and into my beliefs around objectivity in journalism had been investigated. And this is all very strange, because I'm going through the tenure process. My mid-tenure review had just been done last year. Like all faculty, it was put off for a year because of COVID on my timeline, but I got a glowing mid-tenure review. And my endowed chair, the Daniel Renberg Chair of Social Justice and Reporting, had just been renewed in October. The university has praised and done a lot of PR about the work that I do around objectivity in journalism and social justice journalism. They put me on the cover of the alumni magazine just the year before. What they don't like is that I am now applying the same social justice journalism principles that I've applied to race and that I've applied to LGBTQ people, to COVID and HIV, that I was now applying those to Palestine. And so they don't like that. And that the Congress is putting pressure on them to put pressure on me, they're aiding that. So it's a really, really dangerous and sad situation. I'll be fine personally, no matter what happens. But the idea that a social justice journalism professorship cannot talk about one of the most important social justice measures, issues of our time, the genocide in Gaza, that a journalism professor can't talk about a issue and a situation where 171 of our colleagues have been murdered, journalists in Gaza, that we can't talk about these things, that we can't take a stand for free expression and the safety of our students on campus as they're becoming more militarized. All of this is, of course, extremely upsetting.
And Steve Thrasher, what are the specific charges against you? And also, what has been the reaction of your fellow faculty members?
I really haven't talked. I mean, this is the first time that I'm really talking about it publicly. I made a commitment to myself that I would finish my next book and not get derailed from that. And I finished it on Tuesday. So now I'm talking to you on Thursday. I don't want to get too much into the specifics, but one of them is called complaints against you. And this is a very vague thing that's come up all over the country, that they'll say that there are complaints. And the complaints, which I've seen, which there's no merit to, those complaints are very much at odds with what was written up for me in my mid-tenure review, in which my mid-tenure review, Dean Whitaker wrote that I go above and beyond the call for my students. And my endowed chair, which was also renewed, I got very specific praise about being a leader in the field of journalism education. And I've received awards for my mentorship of Northwestern students. So none of that really bears much on the complaints. Also, I was told about my use of social media, which is something that I have done with a lot of passion at times, but with part of my journalism practice to speak about issues that are important to me. And in the Northwestern University magazine article that was about me when my book came out, they actually highlighted in a very positive way the way that I use social media. Again, I don't think they like me using the tools that I've used to talk about HIV, LGBTQ issues, and race issues to be applying it towards Gaza, because all of the complaints about my social media are about interactions that I've had with people about Palestine. And the third one is an incredibly ridiculous thing to be complaining about. It's about my commitment to the idea of objectivity in journalism. And this is something I've talked about on Democracy Now! Before. It was part of what my application and my job talk when I was hired as the Daniel Remberg Chair of Social Justice and Reporting. And it's been a cornerstone of the books I teach, like Lewis Wallace's The View from Somewhere, guests I've brought into campus. Part of my practice is that I don't believe in the idea of faux objectivity in journalism. I do believe in rigor and putting a lot of effort into your work, and that viewers, listeners, and readers have a right to know the positionality of the person reporting the news to them, because that gives them a frame of reference for how they can think about it critically. But this idea that somehow I am not objective enough when my job is focusing on social justice and journalism and LGBTQ issues, and when I had just been very glowingly reappointed for doing my job, and that the university has very much embraced my book and many of the articles I've written that come from a position of social justice, is really a ridiculous thing. The field of journalism education, like all academic disciplines, has ways that people argue about the central tenets of that discipline. One of them is objectivity. People have different feelings about it. I've made mine clear. But this is not something that should be, you know, anyway disqualifying for someone who has a professorship that is focused on social justice issues.
And before we turn to another professor, this one at Columbia University School of Law in New York, Stephen Thrasher, your message to the returning academic community, to professors and students alike.
My message is, we have nothing to be ashamed of. We have nothing to be afraid of. We are doing something that is very important. And back in October, I'm not yet tenured. I'm filing for tenure, and I plan to file for tenure on schedule this fall, because I think that my record deserves to let me have that that hearing. But back in October, after everything started getting really, really bad in Gaza, I made a video asking, you know, should untenured professors like myself talk about this? And I said, absolutely, because it's a moral issue. If you become tenured trying to stay silent through this stuff, you'll become the kind of professor you don't want to be. And even though I have been physically beaten up by the police of my university, I've been interrogated in front of Congress, I've been threatened with jail, and now I am suspended with pay and not allowed to teach. This is the work that we need to do in these very difficult moments. This is a genocide. This is something that is having an enormous impact, not just on many of us in the United States, but on 600,000 students who've lost their ability to get to school in Gaza, on 14,000 children who've been killed in Gaza. And so what we have to do as educators is teach. And even if I don't, I hope I go back into the classroom at Northwestern, but even if I don't, maybe the teaching that I have to do is what I'm doing right now. Maybe all of us as educators right now, the most important teaching we can do is to teach our students that there are things that are morally important that we have to speak about, and that we have to show our students that they are worth taking the consequences. But ultimately, we are going to be okay, because what we are doing is something that is righteous.
Stephen Thrasher is chair of social justice and reporting at the Medill School of Journalism at Northwestern University in Chicago, author of The Viral Underclass. Next up, we'll be joined by Columbia University professor Catherine Franke, now under investigation after an interview she did on Democracy Now! Stay with us.
Tasted freedom, soon those hellish skies turn to blue and starry nights. As our voices start to rise, we're ending an apartheid. Hold on.
Yatalin by Dana Salah. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. As we continue our look at the academic war on dissent on college campuses, we're joined now by another acclaimed professor who has long been outspoken in her support of Palestinian rights and could lose her job at the Columbia University School of Law after she was denounced in a congressional hearing and more. Columbia University School of Law Professor Catherine Franke is a member of the Executive Committee of the Center for Palestine Studies on the Board of Palestine Legal. In April, then-president of Columbia University, Manoush Shafiq, was grilled at a congressional hearing on allegations of anti-Semitism on campus by New York Republican Congressmember Elise Stefanik.
Let me ask about Professor Catherine Frank from the Columbia Law School, who said that all Israeli students who have served in the IDF are dangerous and shouldn't be on campus. What disciplinary action has been taken against that professor?
I agree with you that those comments are completely unacceptable and discriminatory.
But I'm asking you what disciplinary action has been taken.
She has been spoken to by a very senior person in the administration, and she has said that that was not what she intended to say.
Do you see the concern that speaking to these professors is not enough, and it's sending a message across the university that this is tolerated, these anti-Semitic statements from a position of authority in professors in the classroom is tolerated?
That was in April. Two Columbia University professors then claimed Professor Catherine Franke had created a hostile environment for Israeli members of the Columbia community after she appeared on Democracy Now! In January to discuss a chemical attack on pro-Palestinian student activists at Columbia. Let's go to some of that interview with Professor Franke.
Columbia has a program with a graduate relationship with older students from other countries, including Israel. And it's something that many of us were concerned about because so many of those Israeli students who then come to the Columbia campus are coming right out of their military service. And they've been known to harass Palestinian and other students on our campus. And it's something the university has not taken seriously in the past. But we've never seen anything like this. And the students were able to identify three of these exchange students, basically, from Israel who had just come out of military service, who were spraying the pro-Palestinian students with this skunk water. And they were disguised in keffiyeh so that they could mix in with the students who were demanding that the university divest from companies that are supporting the occupation and the war and were protesting and demanding a ceasefire. So we know who they were.
So a number of the pro-Palestinian students who were hit with that chemical spray were hospitalized. After this interview, Columbia Professor Franke now faces termination after two Columbia professors filed a complaint against her with Columbia's Office of Equal Opportunity and Affirmative Action. She's now represented by attorney Kathleen Paradis and the Center for Constitutional Rights. For decades, Kathleen Paradis was a senior partner at Outen and Golden, and she, along with a law firm, represented Professor Franke. But Paradis resigned from the law firm a few weeks ago following the firm's sudden decision to terminate Franke as a client, saying she was too controversial. They're both joining us now. Welcome to Democracy Now! Professor Franke, let's begin with you. You are facing termination at Columbia School of Law?
It's possible, Amy. That's on the table and has never been ruled out. And in the climate in which we are now living, particularly at Columbia, things that used to be routine and expected are not happening. There's an overreaction by the university, a weaponization of the disciplinary system against students and faculty in ways that in my over 40 years at Columbia, I have never seen. So inshallah, that will not happen. I will not be terminated. And I fully expect I'll be exonerated and found, as your audience just saw, I have not said anti-Semitic things about Israeli students. But it's hard to know what's going to happen. We have a new administration, a new president. I'm hoping for the best with her, but I don't know.
So, Kathleen Paradis, if you can explain what happened. You've been representing Catherine Franke, your law firm, Outen and Golden, which you've been a senior partner at for many years.
Catherine became a client in February, shortly after the charges were filed against her, internal charges, frivolous charges, in my opinion. But in these days, frivolous charges are weaponized. We've been processing it, negotiating, engaging with the investigators. And as Catherine became more and more high profile, more and more controversial, as our institutions have been failing us all over the place, my law firm, I believe, also failed us by deciding that Catherine was too controversial and suddenly, over my objection, terminated the representation.
So you're still representing her?
I am, but my firm isn't.
And you're not with your firm anymore?
I quit.
You're a Jewish attorney.
I'm Jewish.
Professor Frankie, I wanted to ask you, you mentioned that you've been a part of the Columbia community now for more than 40 years. Could you compare the climate right now at universities like Columbia to past uprisings of students or protests in previous decades?
Well, Juan, you know Columbia and its history and proud history of being a place where students protested around a wide range of current events, whether it was during your era in the 68 protests against Vietnam or racism on campus or domestically, or more recently, students have protested around divestment, the university's divestment from fossil fuels, creating a Black Studies department, the Iraq wars, DACA, you know, the ending of DACA by the Trump administration. South African apartheid. Columbia has always been a platform for students to engage the world, learn about the world, be critical analysts of what's happening in their world, both in the classroom and outside the classroom. And what we're seeing now is that the university will no longer tolerate protests and critical engagement. I think it's important to recognize the problem here is not just what's happening in the, like the images you're seeing here, a protest outside the buildings, but they're also regulating what we can do inside the buildings. They're monitoring our syllabi. I have a colleague who was fired because he had the nerve to bring a settler colonial analysis to the Israeli project, the occupation of Palestinians, something that is done routinely in academic settings. He was told, no, that's a step too far. We can't talk that way about Israel or Palestine, and he was terminated. So not only is the university allowing itself to be weaponized by the right-wing conservative politicians in D.C., in ways that are squelching and then punishing student protests, but the faculty are now experiencing it as well. And I have to say, this is what I fear for this fall, is a new kind of surveillance, a new kind of chilling of how we teach our classes, and then the students who are in our classes actually go to the university and drop a dime, if you will, but complain about us because we have the nerve to mention Palestine in our classes. And I know several colleagues who are under investigation right now for the fact that they incorporated into their courses readings that had to do with Israel-Palestine. And the students said, oh, that made me feel uncomfortable. And therefore, I'm going to file a complaint against you that you are anti-Semitic. Almost all of these professors are Jewish professors who actually are experts in things like the Holocaust, in things like collective trauma. So the readings were relevant. But Juan, our campus has become unrecognizable. I want to invite you back to spend some time on campus and for you to see how it is transformed.
Yeah, I'd also like to ask Kathleen Paradis if you could share with us some more of what happened within your law firm, the idea that a powerful law firm even is now afraid to tackle issues related to individuals accused of some wrongdoing in terms of Palestine.
I don't want this to be about me or my law firm. I want it to be about Catherine. But what happened at Outen and Golden is the kind of thing that's happening all over. My firm prides itself on representing employees who get in trouble at work, accused of doing things that they didn't do. That's exactly what's happening with Catherine. But because of what's happening in Israel-Palestine, even my law firm is ditching clients who have a righteous claim. And it's sad, it's disappointing, and unfortunately, as I said, our institutions are failing us.
I want to bring into this conversation another professor, Natasha Leonard, columnist at The Intercept, associate director of the Creative Publishing and Critical Journalism Program at the New School, not far from Columbia University. Her most recent piece, College Administrators Spent Summer Break Dreaming Up Ways to Squash Gaza Protests. Can you put Professor Thrasher and Professor Frankie's experience in a broader context of the universities from here in New York, NYU, to other universities around the country?
Absolutely. And thank you. It's lovely to be back. And I firstly want to say thank you to Professor Frankie and Professor Thrasher for being among the professors who refuse to be silenced in this moment of what is widely being called a new McCarthyism. And I think that's an accurate description. Their cases are not unusual. And it is indeed sad. And it is indeed disappointing. Indeed, no less than ghoulish. We are having both de facto and through policy, both in terms of new regulations and student conduct guides coming through for this semester, as well as punitive actions against students and professors, a real reification of the claim that Israel critical speech and pro-Palestinian speech should count under violations of Title VI non-discrimination law and regulations and policy in universities. What that does is align university policy with the right-wing agenda of Congress and right-wing lawmakers who follow in the footsteps of a right-wing Israeli U.S. Consensus. And I think if a university is not a place where that can be critically challenged, especially at a time of genocide, when there are no universities left standing in Gaza, which we cannot forget, and the concerns of our academy is the speech of professors speaking out for academic freedom and speaking out for the liberation of an occupied people. We're in very dark times indeed.
And Natasha Leonard, you write in your piece in The Intercept that, quote, tucked into a document purportedly offering clarification on school policy, the NYU, New York University guidelines, introduce an unprecedented expansion of protected classes to include Zionists and Zionism?
Yes, this is a very exemplary, in the worst of ways, document that was just released by the administration at NYU. It is a new updated guide of student conduct about non-discrimination and harassment. It goes further than any document I've seen in asserting that Zionism, when used critically, should or at least readily can be understood as, and I quote the document, a code word. It doesn't say that occasionally by anti-Semites that Zionism is used as a code word. It takes that as a given. So that is, to clarify, that is a student conduct guide, very poorly written, very open to misuse, that is asserting that the political ideology founded in the 19th century of the ethno-state of Israel being a Zionist project, that should be considered part of the protected class of Jewish identity, religion, and ethnic and shared ancestry. That is what we're seeing in attempts in state houses nationwide to attach Zionism, the political ideology, to the protected class of Jewish identity. It's extremely dangerous. It performs de facto apologia for Israel. And to have that put into writing by a university so clearly is just open for further abuses and an escalation of the sort of repression we've already seen.
Professor Frankie?
Well, I teach a class on citizenship and nationality in Israel and Palestine, and we begin with a critical look at the concept of Zionism. Of course, it was advanced as a place, as an idea about the safety of the Jewish people being located in Mandate Palestine. But there were plenty of Jewish people at the time who said this is actually a horrible idea from the perspective of the safety of Jewish people, because what it says is the Jews all belong in Israel and nowhere else, not in Europe, not in the United States, nowhere else. And so this will lead to more violence, more expulsions, more anti-Semitic pogroms if we lean in too much to the idea that Jews belong primarily and especially in Israel. And those were critiques coming from Jews, again, themselves. So if we are not allowed to talk about that anymore in universities, what we've done is surrender the very idea of the university itself. And that is so much what troubled us about Manoush Shafiq, our president, former president of Columbia's testimony in Congress, and some of those other presidents who came, who were called before Congress, is they not only did not put up a robust defense of the idea of a university where we teach students how to be critical thinkers in such a critical time, but they actually joined in to the criticism of the university. My president did not stand up for any one of us, nor did Professor Thrasher's at Northwestern. And this is part of what concerns me, is that our universities are places now where we could not have a protest and say things that are now being said in Tel Aviv by Israelis. The protests that are happening there this week, if they took place on Columbia's campus, our students would be expelled or charged with very serious disciplinary violations. This is where we've come. It's impossible to talk about the kinds of things that, Amy, in your setup, of the horrible things that are happening right this week in Jenin, in Gaza. We can't talk about that at Columbia. So that's part of what concerns me, is that we don't know our history, and these new policies are keeping us from learning it.